and welcome to episode 35 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Kitty.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Sydney.
Today we'll be talking about the Cult of the New, or maybe this is just an excuse to have a game intervention for Chris. Anything is possible.
Yeah.
But first, thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Jiljam, Shane Poole, and George. If you're interested in supporting us on Patreon or in any other way, visit our webpage, tabletopgametalk.com, and click on the Support Us button in the upper right corner. All of our Patreon levels include free auto entries into all of our contests with bonus entries as well. Now, let's go off topic with some news, announcements, and feedback.
Excellent work.
You will note our first announcement is, I'm not Josh.
And we have a Sydney, which is... special occasion.
We're very excited. Yes. We have a Sydney. She said she would never do it, but here she is. Here
she is. Thanks, Josh.
Yeah. So Josh had a family thing that he had to go to at the last minute. So Sydney decided that she would sit down and join us.
Anything is better than studying for the CPA.
There you go.
True.
So it's like CPA or podcast, you choose. And it was actually a tough decision for her. But let's see. Let's get into some quick announcements so we can get into the actual show part. First, another congratulations to our winners of the Stronghold Games contest, Field of Green. Jason Strong, again, congratulations. He emailed me today because I hadn't got a chance to get back to him yet.
Chris.
I replied to him right away, I promise. But he's like, I just listened to the show. Is there anything I need to do? I'm like, no, but thanks for reminding me that I need to send that email.
Drop that ball.
Yeah, this was a really, really busy week. Mike Smith, winner of our t-shirt, I promise I will email you by the time you hear this episode. I just need your t-shirt size. So if you email me before, well, hopefully I email you before this. So anyway... Talking about our current giveaway, Santorini. So this is a cool little game that we started playing. This is not sponsored by anybody, but Roxley is the publisher of the game that did a great job. So we're giving it away along with the expansion. Like all of our giveaways, you enter by going to tabletopgametalk.com. Click on the giveaways button in the upper right. This one, the deadline is April 30th, midnight your time, wherever you might be. Mostly because I'm going to check it on Saturday, and that's when I do all the work. And then I have Sydney look over it. She's just going to smile and nod as I say this part, because she has no idea what I'm talking about. So it's an independent accountant checking over the work of the drawing.
Studying audit now anyway.
There you go. And there is a question up there. I want to know what your favorite game is to play with casual gamers. Kind of relates to a number of topics we've been talking about. This has no bearing on anything except for my own curiosity. Am I missing a good game that I should go get? Uh-oh. And yeah, so those are our giveaways. The other big news this week, and this is huge, in 35 episodes, I do not believe this has happened. I did not kickstart anything this week. Nothing. I did go in and star a couple things, and I'm like, I want to take a look. All right, you guys don't need to have silent responses. We're on a podcast.
The cat was just really funny.
The cat jumped on my lap, and I was like, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do?
I mean, it wasn't relevant to the podcast, or I would.
Sure, I'll give you that. Anyway, back to me. So normally Sydney is in the back, and the cats can hang around with her, and now the cat's here saying, wait a minute, you're in the wrong spot. But anyway, nothing to kickstart. You guys just are terrible people, but...
You just planned this so that I wouldn't know you were kickstarting more things.
I'm probably going to end up kickstarting things. I listened to a podcast today, and they were talking about two different D&D 5th edition things that I went to, and I was almost going to back. I was so close to it, and then I did not, and I should, and then I shouldn't. And then this episode is called Cult of the New, and I'm like, man, I just buy a lot of new things, even though I'm never going to play them, so that's why I didn't do it.
That's true.
Yeah, so we're gonna just this is a therapy episode. It's fine. Let's go right into some feedback and get me off the
All right, so quick. Let's get to some feedback about past episodes. And if you have feedback about this or any of our previous episodes, email us at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com and become part of the conversation.
Yep. So this week, last week we talked about board games versus video games. And apparently people don't care too much about board games versus video games. But Sam from New York did send us some feedback to this, and he included some questions. So we're going to combine the quick questions and the feedback all into one. So Sam, this entire off topic is dedicated to you.
Don't you feel special?
I'm just saying, I have a feeling. Oh, also that reminds me, Sam, thank you for, Sam increased his pledge to us on Patreon this week. So
thank you
very much. It's very appreciated. So he starts out with a few general questions that came to mind while listening to the last show. Technically, I'm cutting out in a line or two, but we're jumping right to the good stuff. Mm-hmm. Not that the front part wasn't good. That actually was good. I was talking about it.
All right. Just read.
How do you feel about owning multiple games that fill similar niches, whether mechanically or theme-wise? Example, does Burke's Gambit make the resistance unnecessary for you to keep in your collection because the one expands on the mechanics of the other? Do you need multiple one knight insert monster type here? Does Gloomhaven lead you to retire other fantasy dungeon crawls? I love this question.
Because Chris never retires anything.
Well, I don't know. This, like I said, this topic's gotten me to do a lot of like
soul searching.
Yeah.
It also makes you feel good about yourself when you're thinking about new games that you could come up with. And like, I can take a little bit from that game and a little bit from that and a little bit from that. And it's all the same thing.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a good point because Sydney has to listen to me talk about different game designs and stuff that I'm like, oh, and I'm going to do this and this, and I'm going to take that from that. It's just part of the reason. And not a small part of the reason why I have so many games, even if they're in the same genre, is because I like to study the systems. Burke's Gambit, you guys have both played it. Does mm-hmm. this replace, and Kitty, understanding that you don't like either of them, but does Burke's Gambit replace Resistance?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think it does. I actually enjoy Resistance more, and I think that Burke's Gambit was worth getting to try it out, and it is fun, and maybe other people would like it more and would want to keep it, but if this was me, I'd be more likely to get rid of that one. I don't think that the more basic game is necessarily bad, kind of feeding into our topic.
That's true.
I think also things have different genres might have the same mechanics or different themes might have different mechanics, and the way that you fill all of the different mechanics and themes is you have combinations of all of them. So in this case, like, this was more space themed, and you know, Avalon is less so, and Resistance very similar, but you know, different theme, and so Werewolf completely different. And so, like, even though these games are super similar mechanically, you might get into being a captain of a ship more than you might being a werewolf.
Right. Which is a great point, because so even though the mechanics are similar, and honestly, they're not that similar. Avalon and Resistance are basically identical. Mm-hmm. That's true. Just a couple extra rolls. It's basically an expansion. But Burke's Gambit, I really like it. I like the mechanics better than I like the Avalon mechanics. I might be in a minority there, but I really like how fast it flows. I like that it's a mechanical way of getting someone out as opposed to more accusatory.
I just felt like I didn't play it enough to understand, and Chris was making me a little crazy by kind of what is it called?
I narrated what everyone should do.
Yeah, you're basically like, well, if you're a good guy at this point, you should do this, and if you're a bad guy at this point, you should do this.
You gave strategic advice.
And when I was thinking of But in a way that if I was the bad guy and I was thinking of doing that thing already, I was like, well, now if I do that, I've basically outed myself. Mm-hmm. And that might not be the worst thing, but it might not be the best thing right now. And I didn't have enough base knowledge to be like,
and then Chris made it obvious to everyone else. So even if your action would have made it obvious to just Chris, he then made it like plain to everyone. If she does this, she's bad.
In my defense, everyone, this was the very first game and I was just teaching strategy as we were playing.
In our defense, we were bad together. So
this was game two and it made me crazy.
Well, game two.
Or game one, I guess, was the one where I was bad.
Yeah, game one is where I was basically calling out if you were in this particular role. Because I was good. I didn't know who was bad. And even if I were bad, I normally do the same thing just so people can understand the strategy. In game two, I was basically just psyching you guys out to make sure that I knew who was evil. And I still didn't know. I did not know either of you are evil. But it leads to a good point. In Burke's Gambit, coming out as evil is a strategy. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Resistance or Avalon or Werewolf, obviously, mm-hmm. you don't want to come out as evil. You always want to hide that.
Right.
So sometimes it doesn't matter if you're evil or not, especially if you know you have the parasite. Fine, I'm evil. Go ahead. Kill me.
It's almost more like a super simplified Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
Than
yeah.
it is. Like it melds those two yep. together.
That's a fantastic yeah. example.
Because you were evil in, and we should say, Burke's Gambit is a social deduction game where you have a role, so you're good or bad, and you also are potentially infected by a parasite. The good guys are trying to vote off the person with the parasite, whether that's good or bad, it doesn't matter as long as the parasite goes out the airlock. Blue team wins.
Well, during the gameplay, they're trying to figure out who has
sure. it. Sure. Yeah. The gameplay is about figuring out who has the parasite, if someone's good or bad. The red team just wants to make sure the parasite's still on the ship by the time you get back. That's the whole game, for the most part. So if you're a bad guy and you know you're infected, it doesn't matter if you tell anyone. Mm-hmm. They're not going to kill you because that shuffles the parasite and then they lose all the information.
And you can never figure out if you yourself have the parasite. You're the only person that you can't figure it out. But other people can look at your card and say whatever they want during the game.
Exactly.
Social deduction games make me yelly, and I don't like that about myself, so I try to avoid it.
I actually think social deduction games make everyone a bit yelly at times, which is kind of what makes it fun.
It's when they get quiet that you're like, okay, you're the werewolf.
Yeah. So, again, I don't know that we've answered the question. Well, maybe we have in a roundabout way, because we're talking about Burke's Gambit, and we're talking about Avalon, and we're talking about how each of these games have a slightly different experience.
That's true. I think, though, that they're similar enough that maybe I would choose my favorite and keep that one and not keep the rest. But you have to try the new mm-hmm. and then decide.
Yeah.
I actually feel more so about work replacement games than I do about other genres that I don't need to have multiples of them. I can play the one or two I like the most and will enjoy them the most. But with other genres like social deduction, maybe because it's my favorite genre, I can have a million of them, play a million of them, and love
yeah. Whereas I feel I could have all the worker placement games. I'm like, yes, give them point yep. salad. Right? Let's go on crazy, weird missions and explore the ocean. Like, I, you know. Yeah.
Now, as far as do I need multiple copies of One Night Whatever? No. And I almost, anytime that game comes out, I almost always just use the basic rules. Mm-hmm. A lot of it because I don't want to teach more rules than I have to. And each of the expansions adds more to it. Now, if I'm playing the same game with a group of people, and we'll get into the whole that in a minute, then maybe I can start adding in these other things because everyone already knows and we can easily add things over time. But I'm not going to start with like four versions of One Night X and put mm-hmm. it all and say, all right, let's do this.
I feel like we should also address Gloomhaven, where it's such a campaign-style game
yeah.
that I feel like it might not replace a regular dungeon crawl that you can play in one sitting versus Gloomhaven, where you've undertaken an epic undertaking.
Yeah, mm-hmm. an epic storyline. Now, Sydney and I did play a random encounter in Gloomhaven,
yeah.
and you can do that by itself without it actually affecting the campaign at all. Mm-hmm. But at this point, Gloomhaven basically replaces all games for me. So there's a tricky...
I was going to say, conceptually, we might say no. But in practice, we've actually gotten together like once a week to play Gloomhaven. And we haven't picked up D&D again or a different dungeon crawl.
Yep.
So in practice right now, we actually... That's probably true.
Yeah. But I still like the idea of Arcadia Quest, for example, which is a kind of a mini... like six games together as opposed to 95. But I was looking at the new expansion Infernal for Arcadia Quest this week, and I didn't pick it up because I'm like, I'm not going to play this. I have Gloomhaven right now. I know this week's been weird. Just saying.
Embrace the change, yes. Chris.
So I think it is important sometimes to have a set of games that you can go to... And sometimes it might replace new things. It's just, it's a one-off question. It's really hard. And I have a bunch of space exploration games, and I have anything that has fantasy on it, and just, yeah. Sam, you ask hard questions. All right, next question.
I got another one for you. What are some of the games that have been collecting dust on the shelves of your collections that have not been opened even once?
Yeah, so I put a couple of them on the table. Now,
Not Santorini.
The first one, and this one I believe is yours, Sydney.
It is mine. I actually, so before I met you, this might actually work well into our theme later. I didn't buy games until I played them. I would play them in a game room of a convention and fall in love with it and then go home and play it because I needed to own it because it was an amazing game. So Firefly was one of those. I actually had a game night with some friends. We played Firefly because someone else owned it, loved the game, got it, brought it back here, and it never got to the front of like all the games all of us wanted to play. And there are some aspects of the game that are not as pleasant for certain people to play, right? Like the length of the game. And so it just never happened.
Yeah. Cause so Firefly is a great example. Cause I have a couple of games like this too, that I may have opened, but we've never actually played. And I have some that are just sealed up. So Firefly, the game is about a 4 to 6 hour game.
Exactly.
So it can last quite some time and you have to be dedicated to it, and mm-hmm. you have to learn the rules and all that, although it comes in such a small box for such a long game.
But if you get a group of people that love Firefly together like I do, then it's an easy play.
Yep. So this is a case where the game is bought, we own it, but we haven't played it mm-hmm. because we just haven't had a chance to get it to the table.
I feel like this happens a lot more with theme games than it happens with other kinds of games. Is because you buy it because you like the theme so much. I love Firefly too. We have Star Trek Catan upstairs. We've got all kinds of games where I bought it because I saw it and I was like, oh, it's a that thing. Mm-hmm. And then I just never got to it.
And Star Trek Catan is still in the shrink wrap too, right?
It is. Mm-hmm. Still shrink wrapped.
Yep.
Don't tell my mom. She actually got it for us.
So, and Star Trek Catan is really just a retheming of Catan. Like you could play Star mm-hmm. Trek Catan without the special cards and it'd be exactly Catan. This is something that actually, it's my copy of it is sitting over at Josh and Gloria's because Gloria will play a Star Trek game, but she may not play Catan. So I'm kind of hoping that eventually we get a chance to break it open and she can try it out.
So what's your other game?
So the other one here, this one's relatively new, Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. Oh. I've heard good things. I want to play it.
I remember when you bought that.
I just haven't had a chance to open it yet.
I've heard great things. One time we went to a game store. This is such a classic game store story, I think. We were talking to the guy there. We were saying like, oh, what's a game you really like playing? Thinking he would recommend something we could get. And he talked about this game, but it was out of print at the time. Oh. And he sold us on it. And he was talking about it for 30 minutes or more. Like, and we were like, oh, yeah. So can we get a copy? Is it somewhere here? He's like, oh, no, it's out of print now.
Yeah, that's like coming in and saying, so what's the best dungeon crawl? Gloomhaven. You could do this and this and this and this.
Right.
You're in the store. It's like, but you won't be able to get it till August 30th. Thank you.
This one didn't even have like a publishing date set when he said it. He was like, oh, yeah, there was a small first run and they're working on it, but there's no date yet. And we're like, nice. Yep.
Well, a couple other games. Actually, Time Stories and all of its expansions are still in the shrink. Because
partially my fault.
Not partially, all. Sydney played the first one with a different group and came out with like the very edge case where you had to play through
We got to the point at which we had gone through it a couple times and we got to the end, one step away from the end, and then had to restart. But we had figured out exactly what to do to get to the end, and we didn't have the wherewithal to sit through doing every single thing again, knowing that like we had gotten there. And so we had finished it without finishing it.
Yeah. So that left a sour taste, and then she never wanted to play the game again, and now I have all the expansions, and this is a game where you can only play it once, mm-hmm. so I have to wait for it to have the right group. Now, I don't have to play the same group for every expansion, but you kind of want to play the same people until you've beat it, so it's maybe a 3 to 4 hour game. So, way too many other games over there, too, but I just want to go over Forbidden Stars. I got that because it looks amazing. Cry Havoc, which I really, really need to get to the table because this game looks amazing. I was so excited to get it, like one of the early copies, and I just never got a chance to play it. Twilight Imperium is a hugely long game that I haven't been able to get to the table.
I actually have a mushroom game that I got at a Gen Con because you were buying games, and you were buying, like, a lot of them, and I hadn't bought a single one, and I kind of felt a little inadequate, and it's still sitting in the shrink wrap.
Yep, so that ends up happening. All right, I love this next question.
All right, how has 34 podcasts changed your views on tabletop games? Not just moderate gamers like Josh and Kitty, but someone who's really into games like Chris.
So this is a tricky question because, number one, this is only, we're 20% into this particular podcast for Sydney. But Kitty, what do you think? After doing the gaming podcast for 9 months now.
I definitely think more about games while I play. Not necessarily the strategy or how I'm playing, but the design, what I'm seeing, what type of game. I have learned a lot about games. I definitely picked up some game design knowledge, and now I find myself saying things that I think are, oh, everyone knows this, and then having people just blank stare at me and like, oh, yeah. Like, I forgot. I'm not just a plain old person anymore.
It's a deck builder with a drafting mechanic, obviously.
I know.
I have a teeny bit of a peripheral. Now that you have been doing it for so long, we actually play more games and talk about games more. And that's been a fantastic experience for me because we met doing board games. And so I love the fact that it's a topic of conversation more often.
Yeah, and that's basically mine is I play a lot more games now than I did before because we go out of our way to do it. Oftentimes, you know, Josh, Kitty, and I will play a game before we record. And that is like kind of a forced game night. We set up a weekly game night with your friend Sarah to do Gloomhaven. We're actually going to go play Zaya with Josh this Friday. You know, so it's these gaming times get set up and I get to play a lot more games. So that's kind of fun. And I still haven't written anything off for board games. But this year, the accountant's going to teach me how to write off all that stuff.
I got this.
Yeah. But I still think I love games. I am, since the podcast started, I do buy even more games than I did before. Because now I'm like, oh, I want to try this and check this out, or I want to talk about that. Fortunately, Gloomhaven has been on the top of the hotness list on BoardGameGeek for what seems like 5 months now. And so every once in a while, something else will like kind of peak up and drop down, then peak up and drop down. So there's not a lot of cyclicalness in that list. And
Seeing a lot of stuff that jumps out at you like, I have to have this. I have to have this every so often.
Right. And we're in sort of a dry spell of games. So that time between Christmas and essentially Origins, but, you know, that first quarter or so of the year, there's not a lot of things that come out because it's not a big shopping time. So Kickstarter stuff will come out, i.e. Gloomhaven, but for other things are just not coming up. But that's what I'm doing is I'm always like kind of on the lookout now. I spend a lot more time on BoardGameGeek trying to see what other people are talking about and coming up with topics and stuff. So I really think that another thing is the community, like being able to interact with everyone. Because I'm going to be completely honest. Earlier today, I'm like, I just want to go home and go to sleep, but we have to record. This is Monday, but there was a holiday. Last week, I was like, work was really crazy. I ended up flying down to Dallas and back during the week, you know, so it's just been a really long period of time. And I was just exhausted. And then I went to the Board Game Geek thread for the input on this episode, and I started reading the stuff there, and I'm like, that thread just revitalized me. I'm like, oh, I can't wait to get home and talk about this. So the community and like the people I've quote unquote met while doing the podcast, that's fantastic as well. So, all right, we are going to go to Actual On Topic, where we'll continue talking about much of the same stuff. So let's do this. I'm back again. In this episode, we're talking about the cult of the new. Those people that always want to play something new instead of something we've played before. What are the driving forces behind it? Is this a good or bad for the industry? And what about the other side, the cult of the old? Oh, and this is Sydney's chance to convince me to play more games more than once. So, good luck.
Yay!
So cult of the new, let's quickly define this. This is a term that's used in, especially if you're in the kind of the board game circles. The cult of the new is the person that always wants to play a new board game. The cult of the old is someone who never wants to play anything new. They only want to play what they know. Spencer would make a great example, if you've listened to past episodes, of a cult of the old. Catan or spades. And that's all he really cares to play. And anytime he has to learn a new game, it's a chore for him. And I don't say that as a bad thing. I say it actually feels like work for him. I have to learn this new thing, and that's not fun. On the other hand, there's people like me that if I play the same game twice, it's only because I'm forced to.
Mm-hmm.
There are exceptions, and we'll get to that. So that's
depends on the length of the game.
Yeah.
You'll play short games lots in a row.
Yeah, especially. Totally.
Yep. And that's sort of like the old games that I play. And we're going to use old and new in a very vague terms. I'm not talking like, oh, this game was out 10 years ago. Just games that I've played before.
Mm-hmm.
Those will normally be quick things that I can teach easily. And if I'm with a group, it's actually kind of what led to the what's your favorite game to play with casual players question for our contest. If I'm with a group and someone says, hey, let's play a game, which happens fairly often, I go over to the 250 games and I just look around and I'm like, I don't want to teach anyone any of these because we're just not in a mind state where it's going to work to plop down a really big and involved game.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes me back to these kind of old standby games of the easier stuff.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we need a sticker system, like Ooh. A library, like
gold star
green is for easy. Yellow is for, like, we can still play this when we're drunk. Red is, you need 6 hours, buddy.
You put a game of Friday for Zaya.
Yes, exactly. But, like, if you're just working with, okay, we have friends over, we just got done with dinner, we're drinking wine, you're not going to break out a game like Zaya. Mm-hmm. No matter how much fun it is or how much you enjoy doing it.
Totally.
It's just...
All right, guys, now's the time for Twilight in Mirror.
Yeah, let's do this. It plays up to six people. We have six people here.
We've got this.
We all have PTO to take off work tomorrow.
Yep. By the way, it's going to be the first 2 hours me just teaching you how to play the game. As I teach myself how to play the game because I haven't played it recently enough to know it off the top of my head.
That's actually one of the reasons that I like replaying games, because teaching oneself is a little bit tricky. And so, like, going to YouTube and getting those, like, how to plays are really nice. But if you know how to play a game already, teaching it to others is one thing. But if everyone knows how to play, the setup and the get going is just so nice.
Yep.
It goes so quick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I started doing reboxings, which, again, I'm terrible at putting things on YouTube right now. I do have a day job sometimes, but I might do like a playthrough of Santorini. I think at least getting the giveaway games on YouTube.
Yeah, definitely.
That I can focus on. But
Santorini is quick too.
It is quick.
Mm-hmm. And fun.
And fun. And cute. If you like chibitzy stuff. You don't like the chibitzy stuff?
I like it.
Oh, okay. I thought you said
No, I said I like it. And okay. I said it in like a Annie the Orphan kind of way. I don't know.
That works.
Leaping lizards.
Yeah. But so the reboxings are so I can get a game to the table as quickly as possible. Like, that's really the part where I say, if I lose them while I'm setting it up, if I lose that interest, then it's not going to end up happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, otherwise you have to have people dedicated. It's like, okay, we're going to come over and play this game.
But how often is someone who is in the cult of the new going to be someone who has a group of people that may casually want to play a game, or is more likely to have friends that want to play games on a regular basis, or more in-depth games?
It's my life.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, because I have a lot of friends that are willing to play games. None of them are into it as much as I am on the same level of frequency that I would like.
Mm-hmm.
So I can get Kitty and Josh to play a game. Although, honestly, and Josh isn't here, so it's not really picking on him, but he doesn't like playing new games as much. He wants to play games that, you know, he's played before.
Mm-hmm.
And like when we play with Sarah, like, we know what we're going to play. We get together for that game. When we play with Josh and Reed, we're going to get together to play that specific game.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the exception, really.
Right.
You know.
Gloomhaven and Zaya, respectively.
Gloomhaven, yes. But when the family's over or friends are over casually and we're having a few drinks and people are like, oh, you have so many games, let's play something. That happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, Okay, well, let's see. We can play Avalon or One Night Werewolf because those simple social deduction games.
Or something that's not social deduction, like yeah. Santorini.
Like Santorini. Oh.
It's a really fun one that no one gets yelly.
Yep, but it only plays to four people. So when
Great
you're in
Western
a bigger
Trail
crew.
Was actually pretty fantastic, and it went really quick after we got going.
Really quick is 4 hours.
That's very true.
Yeah. So it's a game where you kind of lose yourself in it, mm-hmm. but it's still... If I put this down and explain it to someone who's had two or three glasses of wine, they're That's not true. Going to gather that all together. You have to dedicate yourself to it.
I like... You're just going to yell at me because I'm going to say Carcassonne.
But that's actually not wrong. It really isn't.
It's a great game to play with people where you're just sitting down because you don't have to worry about the scoring mm-hmm. really until the end. And then only one person really has to... know the scoring rules, and you mm-hmm. sit there and you take off your things and you just move around the board right. and yeah, one person has to be, you know, kind of in charge of that, but as long as you sort of know what scores points, you sort of know what you're doing, you don't have to be like Chris is sitting there calculating his score in his head at each moment. At least the one time we played
yeah. well, in a two-player game, but that yeah. that points out a cult of the old versus new. So when I'm looking for a game, I am almost never looking at Carcassonne. It's like, that game is 10 years old. I'm not interested. It may be perfect for the table. Mm-hmm. But me being inducted in this cult, I don't think that way. I should, maybe. I don't know. But it's not what I think. What I think is, and Kitty has a breath, but I just want to quickly finish this thought. What I think is, what new game do I have that would be quick enough to teach people in this area? And I get paralyzed. Because there's too many, like, I don't know the rules yet. I haven't played it yet. But I still want to put this new game at the table as opposed to the old. That was just how Burke's Gambit hit mm-hmm. the table last weekend or 2 weekends ago.
So I had 2 points now that I've almost forgotten. The first was that most people are not Chris or Spencer. We live in the middle.
Absolutely.
We take a little, like, we try new games. If we like them, we bring them into our rotation. When old games get dusty and feel like they've been played too many times, you feel like you're just doing the same thing over and over, they get retired and you have a collection that is usable. Mm-hmm. You don't have to feel like, oh, these I've had these 10 games with me for every move since I was 10 years old and I don't buy new things. Or you don't have to, like, I only play things that came out in the last 3 months. There's a middle ground mm-hmm. here that I think most people live in. But maybe that's my naivete.
I compensate very well with your cult of the new because you teach me a new game and we play new games all the time. And then I get to bring them to my friends. And that's my second, third yep. time playing. And it's a fantastic combination. Like what Kitty was saying, I get to play things more than once, but then I'm playing new things with you all the time. So it's a great balance.
Well, and we played Homeworlds. Like we had a phase of Homeworlds where we played that like almost every day for 2.5-3 months.
It definitely, the ease of being able to play kind of plays into that because being able to take Homeworlds with us wherever we went, restaurants, airports, hotels, whatever, we were able to play that a lot easier. Yeah.
I do think that your social deduction thing is also because those games seem to come out with more frequency than other kinds of games. It seems to me at least that they seem to have more rules than pieces. They're less production heavy. It's easier to just kind of throw a few new mechanics, reskin it, and have a new game out. And they feel completely different sometimes.
Yeah.
And that might be why we play those more often. And that doesn't always make me happy. But so maybe that's why I'm like, cult of the new, because it makes me play social deduction games all the time.
Well, to be completely honest, social deduction games aside, as far as like that genre, I mean, if you're in a group and you're being social, it helps that, you know, that is kind of the go-to genre, or not genre, but type of game. But again, the other night, I didn't pull out Avalon. I pulled out Burke's Gambit mm-hmm. because it's new. Mm-hmm. It's a new social deduction game. I also have Salem. Like, New Salem is another social deduction game mm-hmm. that I want to pull out.
But I feel like a lot of your new games are social deduction games, was a point I was making.
Maybe, especially the ones that you end up seeing, because those are the ones like, oh, here's a game that'll play, you know, 4 to 8 people. And, oh, guess what? There's a hidden role involved.
Is a part of your feel like enjoying the cult of the new, the Kickstarter aspect, the going out and going to game stores and Gen Con and Origins, or is it more the actual games and playing them and that kind of thing?
I'm going to let It's Gotta Be Odin answer this. Look at me segue. But it actually does, it's because he and I are on the same level in this, and he says that at the very beginning. Oh man, I'm totally in the boat with you, Chris. I'm totally addicted. Basically, he says, if I had a choice, I'd almost always pick a new game if it's in the genre that I enjoy. I just love learning new systems and doing my best to master it in one go. And who knows, you might find your new favorite game that you'll play all the time. Yeah, right. So I think that I'm kind of in that boat where I love learning a new system. And I love just exploring that system. To me is almost the majority of the fun of a new game versus trying to figure out how to win in the system, if that makes sense.
I'm going to say this, and I don't want it to sound like an insult, but you're a rules nerd.
Mm-hmm.
You love learning systems. You love the rules.
I think
of the strategy and the actual gameplay is the more fun part to me. The rules are just kind of something I get through to get to the actual gameplay. Whereas I think you are perfectly happy, you've said this before, to sit down, read the rule book, and put it away, and that was enough interaction with that game for you.
I also think you really enjoy putting it away in a new way, or putting it like away in an organized way, and then you're really excited to share that with everyone else.
No, I like taking the rules and making it better, or taking the components and making it better. Like Gloomhaven, every single time Sarah comes over, there's something new. Like I've really pimped that game out.
Yes, you have.
I've taken all of the coins from Seafall, so that's now our gold from adventure to adventure. I've almost painted every single mini in the box.
Coordinated which is with 18. The boards they go with. Yep.
Matched them in color and style with the board and the art. I've replaced a lot of the fiddly components with my own components. Reboxed the whole thing. So yeah, if we're playing a game, I'm always trying to iterate on making that better. Mm-hmm. I don't do that for most games, because most games I don't play enough to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's I play the game, I'll do something to it, and if I play it again, I may refine what I'm doing. But yeah. Now, to be fair, he does follow up with, he does think this is a problem.
Thank you.
Yeah. Part of it is cost, especially if you're a solo player that can't really split the cost out among a group. Or someone who, I don't like splitting costs among the group, because I don't know that... I don't like that sense of who's owns what type of thing. And honestly, I should just give away games. But so I end up just picking up the whole cost. And I'm trying to do it to explore. So I'm like, I'll pick up the cost. Opportunity cost is also another thing that he mentions here, which is really the amount of time it takes to learn a game. You could play your very first game. You could probably play a game and a half the second time you do it. Right. So you can get more games if you don't have to learn the rules, which is kind of what we've gone to. He also mentions carbon footprint, which
yeah. Chris has a huge carbon footprint. There aren't even any house plants in here.
That's actually really true. We just put sod in the front yard, though.
Spencer put sod in the front yard. You should have seen his jeans after that adventure. Yeah. So. I just did the washing.
Yes, but we digress.
Sorry, I got distracted looking at Board Game Geek here. I'm trying to count people who are saying like, oh yeah, I'm in the middle. And it seems to be like 2/3 of the people on here say I live in the middle. And then the other third is Cult of the New. I don't see anyone really who says, and maybe it's just because they're hanging out on Board Game Geek, that might be a specific subset of the gaming culture.
That actually is a good point. If you're listening to this podcast, you are probably Cult of the New because you are in the know. You want to be in the loop on things. You're trying to explore the news, the conversation.
I wouldn't put them necessarily in Cult of the New. I would say they are more aware than a lot of the gaming community at large, but that doesn't necessarily put you in this Cult of the New subset. It just means that you like new things. You're not, I might put you in not cult of the old.
Sure. Fine.
Unlike you, they might not buy every single game that you say you've kickstarted, but you'll say one that really, really makes them interested.
Yes. So I'm not saying you are automatically far new. I'm just saying you are probably not anywhere new near adjacent. Old. Yeah. but if you're listening and you are in the whole, I don't want to play new games, I don't want to learn new games, and you're listening to this, by all means, email us because I want to know.
We'd love to hear more from you.
Yeah, I want to know more about that. So let's see here. The other thing with Cult of the New is a problem to go along with cost. Is it worth spending $50 to $100 to play a game once? Because oftentimes, I would say 80-ish percent of the games I own, that's exactly what I did.
Well, Time Stories sold itself that way. The expansions are so you can play games again, but it was an example of, you know, you're buying this game to play it once, and it was super popular.
Which is why it's perfect for me. There's no expectations to play it again.
I liked the Pandemic Legacy model of, to really enjoy this game, you have need to play it multiple times.
So we're going to jump ahead because we have our show notes are 7 bullet points. But one of the bullet points I really wanted to get to was, and this is how I wrote this down because I wanted to make sure, do campaign or legacy games cure a cult of the newer? Ooh. And the reason I say this is because Gloomhaven, I'm hardcore. There's nobody who knows me that wouldn't say I'm not strong in this buy something new. But Gloomhaven has been my obsession for the past few weeks because every time I play it, it is new. There is new things there. When we played Pandemic Legacy, it was the same game. We kept playing Pandemic Legacy, but I still got to discover new things every time I played it. And I think that I'm not necessarily needing all of these different games. I just need the right games that allow me to continually explore things. I've mentioned it before that I really like asymmetrical games where you start off with a different race or different abilities or different something at the beginning. I like replaying those games because now I get to try something different every time I play. So for me, it's just kind of exploring something new about the game could potentially scratch that itch.
I feel like games that have randomization to them, where the board especially looks different every time. Games like Carcassonne or Catan or even Santorini, where the actions that other players take affect the actual game board so much that you're watching like it build every time feels different. You feel like you don't play the same game over and over and over again. I really enjoy those ones.
I actually think board games have something different to them than card and dice games, because card and dice games are inherently new every time, because like Dominion, for example, all you have to do is own 2 or 3 of the expansions and you have what, thousands of games.
It's a different game every time.
Exactly. And so I'm a very big fan of those games, and I'd play those games again and again and again, because every time it will be different, even if you start with the same things every time.
Yep. And doesn't necessarily card and board games have that feel, but random setup games where every time you play, you're playing a different board. It's a different starting scenario, even though you're playing in the same game.
Sure. I'm going to throw in Labyrinth. It's still my favorite.
Labyrinth.
Have you played Labyrinth with us?
I have not.
Oh, man. It's really fun. Yep. I'll have to bring it down again.
Yep. Totally.
And then, so Tabletop Dad, Michael Olf, has a good point here. Well, actually, more good advice for someone who is in the cult of the new. Yeah. So I'm just going to skip to the part that I'm not going to read everything. If you want to know what we're reading, you can read it along with us. This is at BoardGameGeek.com. Just go to the Tabletop Game Talk podcast page. You can also find it by going to TabletopGameTalk.com/BGG. But Michael says, as to the cost of acquiring these new hot games, that can be eliminated to a degree. How I manage is by volunteering to demonstrate games for a company. Many of the board game publishers have these demo programs, like Steve Jackson, AEG, Stronghold, Portal Games, Eagle Griffin. I could make the list go on for a while, but that gives you a good idea. They will give you the game for free so long as you demonstrate it once or twice for them, depending on the game and the company. Recently, I started doing this for Cry Havoc, my new favorite game. And also, Michael, if you want to play that over tabletop sometime, let me know. And I am enjoying helping others learn the game. other methods lowering prices can be reward programs, miniature markets, do, you know, aftermarket and things like that. Hmm. I did not think about doing this, but all I'm thinking is like, I should sign up for all these demo programs. Yes. I'd get to go out, play games, get games, and it would be like fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think this is a good way to manage that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You also have gaming stores. A lot of gaming stores have playable copies in the store. You can go and check it out there before you buy it.
Or, absolutely.
Friends who have games. We mentioned this, I think, on our last podcast where I think it was in our quick question. We said gaming groups, if everyone goes and buys one game and then you come together, it feels less like you have to spend a fortune doing it just by yourself. You're really working together to maximize your experience. It doesn't make sense for everyone to go out and buy Gloomhaven. Mm-hmm. One person can buy Gloomhaven. One person can get Pandemic Legacy. One person can get other games. There's too many examples for me to pick.
Well, I think buying a game, like, oh, you're the next in a rotation to buy the next game we're playing, mm-hmm. it makes it easier than like splitting the cost of a game.
Right.
Unless it comes up and it's your turn and you have to go buy Gloomhaven. It's not fair to the person who got to buy Santorini.
First of all, whoever owns Gloomhaven is the lucky one.
And they can just play by themselves.
Yeah, and if you can get a hold of it, good luck there. I'm not calling Sydney Kitty. I was just hearing Kitty. Anyway, Sydney, do you want to read Josh's comment?
Sure can.
Because I think this is very interesting as well. This is like the situationalness of it.
So, Josh said, we're situational when it comes to new versus old. We have a roster of tried and true classics that we love to play repeatedly. Xayah, Dominion, One Night Werewolf, Boss Monster. But I'm always on the hunt for a new favorite. Like everyone else said, money is usually the determining factor. So taking advantage of demo copies at game stores or friends that have similar tastes in games, a lot of experience in picking great games, and a lot of games, Chris, are a big help in deciding when to make new purchase for our small collection.
Yep. This one, so full disclosure, Josh is who he plays Xayah with.
Mm-hmm.
This is Josh of Josh and Reed. But I'm almost inspired to kind of remove my collection to, well, not remove it, but reduce it to 50 games.
Good luck.
I want to go through all the games I have and just take out the 50 that I'm like, I can't part with these and see what's left.
Would you mind consulting with me before you get rid of all my games?
I won't get rid of your game. But compared,
you get to have your own 50, Sydney.
Yeah. Yes. And since you only have like 8 of them, you can keep all of them. But this is, you know, a lot of like other people in the industry that do reviews and stuff, they have the top 100 games. So they'll like rotate in. This is my 100. If I'm going to keep something, I have to get rid of something.
Totally.
I don't need 100 games, I don't think. But I want to see. Maybe. I don't know. But unless I start somewhere, I'll never know. Do I really need 250 games?
Totally.
Is that badge so important to me on BoardGameGeek?
I feel like my top 50 would be so different from your top 50.
Yeah.
Out of your same game collection, if we went over here and each picked out 50 boxes, I don't think we would fight over one.
Yeah, I can see that.
I agree.
Steve agrees with Josh. He tries to keep his collection small. I list my wife's games on my profile, but I have been a gamer for over 2 decades and my personal collection is under 30 games.
Good for you.
Yeah. So like that's another thing. It's like I don't need to have a ton of games and still be what I would consider like a hardcore gamer.
Mm-hmm.
And that might help with the whole playing games again. You know, the other problem I have with playing games again is if I get into a game, I really get into the game. Kitty has mentioned like the Dice Masters incident.
Oh, yes.
Gloomhaven is a thing. Like once I start getting into it, I really get into it.
Star Wars the card game.
We played that for a while and I like the living card game from Fantasy Flight.
Homeworlds for a while there.
Homeworlds. And if I don't have someone else that matches that enthusiasm, I have to switch to something new because I can't sort my Star Wars cards over and over and over again if it never hits the table. So that's sort of another problem I have with kind of keeping games that are like, this is my core game, is I will be obsessed with it. How do you manage that?
You find a group to play Gloomhaven with.
Well, sure. So now I only need one game, which honestly, I could Gloomhaven and maybe a handful of others, I could be happy on a desert island.
I feel like some people use meetups for this kind of thing. Absolutely. They look for people who...
Like Gamers Anonymous?
Sarah and I actually met at a meetup.com. There's a meetup in the city that played games every so often, and she met some of her closest friends there too.
Yep. Yeah, I could do that too. Then I have to play with strangers, and that's scary.
I'll go be your buddy, I promise.
All right, if you two come with me, I will do the meetup thing.
I feel like we need to make you try. Just because you've made Josh do so much stuff.
That's true. And well, Sydney and I did go to a meetup. This was over a little year and a half ago. We ended up playing Power Grid.
Oh, yeah.
Which was the first time I'd ever played Power Grid. And we played with, I want to say it's a couple. Mm-hmm. And there might have been a fifth person. I think yes. It was a five-player yep. game. So and if you're listening, I apologize. But so my first experience with that was playing Power Grid with a couple that were like obsessed with the game. Mm-hmm. They knew everything about it. I'd never played before. And I remember making a particular move. And the guy I was playing with was just, it ended up making him lose because I didn't do the optimal move. And so he wasn't able to do something because I had done it instead. And he ended up losing. And all I heard about while he was packing up the game is how, had I not made this suboptimal move, like, why did you do that? That was so suboptimal. I didn't win because you made this move. I'm like, well, that wasn't really my intention to let you win. I didn't win either, but I'm not going to be all broken up.
I won.
Yeah, you won. So it was a team effort. I'll give you that. But that's like the randomness of people. And I'm not saying that's bad, and it makes for an interesting story, but I haven't wanted to go back and play Power Grid since either, even though I actually did enjoy the game itself. Mm. So I don't know. That sounds like me discouraging.
Like we need to invent Tinder for board gamers where you can like rate your games
and
match up with people in your area.
Gosh.
That could work.
We should cut this out of the podcast before anyone else can steal my brilliance. Yeah.
Well, we got to get beta testers, so you're all recruited into our beta testing program.
Oh my gosh.
Swipe left if you like Catan. Swipe right if you like whatever just came out.
Oh my gosh. That's an idea.
That would be fun.
All right.
I don't know if there's enough people. In Chicago, you would think there'd be enough to use it.
I think so.
There are enough game stores in Chicago. You just
get on this. I'm getting into it. Let's see. I do want to get to... So Christy has a really good input here. Again, only kind of paraphrasing some things. Just jumping right to the last downside of the Cult of the New is the potential to miss out on games you wanted to try when others in your group have moved on. It's that feeling that games are on a conveyor belt into the past, and you have to try to catch the things you want to play whilst they're hot or risk missing out. This mostly applies when you're attempting to play someone else's copy, though. It also holds true when becoming difficult to find players for your favorite game. Cry Havoc is exactly this for me. Hmm. I got it when it was all the hotness. I wanted to get it to the table. It just never made it in the rotation. And then all these new games come in and are taking over that slot of learning new games. So Cry Havoc is sitting on the shelf. Even though I really want to play this game. This is another game where I'm like, I may sit down and paint all the miniatures. I don't know because I kind of do more detailed painting than I can mass miniature paint. But it's that cool. And I really, really want to play it. I don't know. Maybe after the podcast, we can play a game.
If you play Roll for the Galaxy with me again, I will play Cry Havoc with you.
All right, fine. And I did like Roll for the Galaxy.
I know, but I've been trying to get it on the table for a while.
Roll for the Galaxy we played probably more often than most games. Actually, that's funny. When Sydney and I play a game, we do tend to play the games more than once. Mm-hmm. Great Western Trail, we never played again afterward.
I played it with Josh and Reed.
But you played with Josh and Reed right after. So you're a good influence on me to play the same games again.
And I feel like that's kind of part of Sydney's game style. She's a move optimizer. She really wants to always know what the best move to make is. And you do have to play a few times. Mm-hmm. I think somebody on Board Game Geek mentioned this. To get good at a game, you have to play it more than once.
Absolutely.
If you want to say like, oh, I'm a really good gamer, you have to have games that you're really good at. And to be really good at a game, you have to practice. You got to play a few times.
That's a great point.
Yep. So, and that's true. Like I say, I'm not necessarily, I play games to play the game, not necessarily to optimize the win strategy. Mm. That's not always true. Homeworlds, love that game, so easy, and I'm playing it to optimize the win strategy.
But. And I think the games that you want to win more are the games that you want to play more, except for the social deduction games. And I think that might also be why those ones come out more, because you actually enjoy the play of those.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Social deduction games, I want to win. I like winning them. I like being good at them. I love being accused. I love that.
You like troll for it.
Yes. You know, quite honestly, and I realized this when we were playing Burke's Gambit the other day, I was actually in some way trolling to pull suspicion onto me, even though I was good. I wasn't necessarily doing it as a strategy either. I was doing it as kind of a...
just more fun.
I have information. I know it's not me, but I'm trying to figure out everything that's going on.
That did help us win, though.
It did help you win.
It did.
Well, in that particular that one, was I knew...
really funny.
I knew exactly what we needed to do, who had the parasite. I knew everything. I just couldn't get everyone else to be convinced of it. So my strategy, which isn't a strategy, backfired.
I just really liked the part where I knew that I said the wrong thing. And I had one of those moments where, like, I was the bad guy. I knew Sydney had the parasite. She was also a bad guy. And we had to not get Sydney voted off. And somebody else knew. And I just, like, screamed out, like, Chris has the parasite! And then stopped talking and just let Sydney talk everyone around. Because Sydney had seen his card and it was just enough.
Right?
No. Like, yep. No one really stopped to consider, wait, why did Kitty know Chris has the parasite? Yeah. that was the most fun I've had playing a social deduction game. But then come the end of that one, I had like a moment where Spencer's like, whoa, chill. take it down a notch.
But I like that. I keep my emotions in check. Like, day-to-day life, Sydney's always like, why aren't you more excited? I'm like, I am. This is just what I look like when I'm excited. So I have, like, kind of a... Oftentimes, people at work might disagree with me as well from time to time. But I try to keep my emotions in check. But in a social deduction game, it allows me to kind of go the extremes.
Mm-hmm.
We get into a lot of yelling.
Yes. But I also always try to do it with a smile. Like, it's a game to me. It's mm-hmm. fun. If someone's accusing me and I'm not that person, that's okay. That's on me. I was not able to convince somebody. And if I lose and I was right, I get to say, I told you I was innocent. If only you had not done this and trusted me, it would have worked out fine. And then the response is, yeah, but you're never really trustworthy. I'm like, aw. True, but aw.
You do it to yourself.
I do.
Because you think it's fun.
It is. I don't know if we're talking about Cult of New or old things anymore. We've gone
so off topic in so many of these. It's just...
So I will say the downside to Cult of the New that I agree with is teaching new games is taxing. It's hard and it's not very fun for someone to sit down and somebody who's learning the game is teaching it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I may have already read the rules. I may have even set it up a couple times, but I don't know how to play the game until you've played the game. And so this is a good learning experience for me. I'm going to play games more than once, and somehow I'm going to make this a rule of if I can't buy a new game until I've retired a game that I've played more than once.
Yay!
Or I'm just saying this game is horrible and I'm not going to play it, but that rarely happens.
Ever.
Yeah, there's not a lot of games where I'm like, this is horrible, I'd never play it again.
Very true.
But, yeah.
Every game has its merits.
And let's not say every game. But we'll say a lot of games.
Almost every game has at least some merit.
There are a handful of games where I play it and then I realize I like this other game better in the same genre with the same type of mechanics. Yep. And I'd rather play that other game again rather than this first game. But there's not really a lot of games I dislike.
Yeah.
This is a little bit like writing, I think. I like to dabble in writing. Nothing is good. You'll never read it. But when I read stories, things that I don't like the author did, I'm like, I want to write something and change it. If I was writing this story, this is where I would take it.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of...
Yeah. I'm going to keep buying games because I like the systems, but I'm going to play the systems more than once because I think that just playing once doesn't really allow you to get to know it as well as you could
mm-hmm.
and iterate on it. And then I'm going to look forward to doing it too. And I'm going to make a list of games that I'm going to keep, and I'm going to attempt to get my collection down to 50, which could mean a whole lot of crate level giveaways in the near future.
Yeah. I'm going to save my games that I like. I'm going to take my collection out of your collection.
I'm not going to get rid of anyone else's games. So, any other final thoughts before we move on?
I don't think so. Although I did like what Christy finished her her Board Game Geek thing with. It's for another topic, but I like her kind of tricking out games idea that she threw in there. It sounds like something fun we could talk about.
It is on the list. We're going to throw one more between it because I think it's a good foundation before we get to tricking out games. But you'll find out that if you actually listen to the end of the episode. And on that note, I have to do a couple things here. I have to hit this button. There, music. All right. Thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So consider leaving us an iTunes review. Email us with your comments or questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. And visit us on our site at tabletopgametalk.com to learn more about becoming part of the conversation. Did I say .com or gmail.com? Anyway, our email address is at Gmail. Finally, a huge thank you to all of our patrons. Emil Jiljam, Shane Poole, George, Tom Bly, Jason Strong, Charles Finch, Lucas Hartso, Michael Ohl, Josh Arntz, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Sean Kelly, Sam from New York, and all the rest. If you'd like to support us via Patreon, you can find out more at tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon. We would love if you did so I could buy more games. And until next week, until we talk about campaign and legacy games, keep playing games and having fun.
Good night.